Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ute Betre. I'm the visiting gender and sexuality studies professor here at Swarthmore College. And it is my absolute pleasure to welcome you today to the second half of our two-day-long event. In this event, we bring theorist Jack Halberstam and writer Antje Ravik-Strubel into dialogue with each other to further the knowledge production and dissemination on female masculinities and potentially on transgender as an umbrella term. Yesterday, Jack gave a brilliant talk titled Trans Asterix, Bodies and Power in the Age of Transgenderism. Today, we will hear Antje read from her newest novel, Into the Woods of the Human Heart, in den Wäldern des menschlichen Herzens, from 2016, which has already been shortlisted for the prestigious Bremer Literaturpreis, the literature prize of the city of Bremen in Germany. Here, she addresses queer desire as well as the crossing of multiple boundaries. Gender boundaries, national boundaries, the boundaries surrounding sexuality, and the ones that we cross when we fall in and out of love. In Into the Woods of the Human Heart, Antje also conceptualizes a trans man, and this character may have been inspired by Jack's gender category of female masculinity. Today's event will begin with this reading. A subsequent conversation between Antje and Jack on embodied and non-embodied gender and on transing, or maybe trans-asterixing, the category of gender will follow. Before I introduce Antje, however, I want to thank the Program of Gender and Sexuality Studies, the German Program, the Intercultural Center, the English Department, as well as the Provost's Office of Swarthmore College for making this event possible. Patty, I hope I haven't forgotten anyone. And the Dean's Office of Swarthmore College. Okay. In particular, I want to thank our Gender and Sexuality Studies Program Coordinator, Dr. Patty White, and our administrative assistants, Anna Averitz and Logan Tiberi Warner. Okay. For their invaluable help and committed work. I also want to thank my colleague, Dr. Hans Jakob Berlin, who is not here today, for his enthusiasm and his continuous support, but also Dr. Zunka Simon for her mentorship and her encouragement regarding this event, particularly in the early stages. Last but not least, I would like to thank our students for being here on the last day of classes and for the really brilliant and great questions that you guys asked Jack yesterday. That made my day and made me really proud. And it also made Patty very proud, so I think we share that. So let me take a minute to introduce German writer Antje Ravik-Strubel. I met Antje in 2012 at the Women in German conference, where she was the guest of honor and read from her novel When Days Plunge into Night, or Sturz der Tage in die Nacht, from 2011. I was not familiar with Antje's novel, nor with her work at that point in time, but while listening to her read, the outstanding literary quality of her writing became immediately clear to me and impressed me deeply. It comes at no surprise that she turned out to be one of the most prolific and critically acclaimed contemporary German authors of her time, actually. Helen Finch characterizes her novels as, quote, celebrating the liberating potential to transcend narrow categories of nation and gender, end quote. Noting that her, quote, gender queer narrators and characters deconstruct binary categories of East and West German identity, butch and femme, male and female, end quote. It is Antje's biography that informs the recurring theme of East and West German identity in her work. She grew up in the GDR and was 15 years old when the Berlin Wall fell, an experience that, according to her, has shaped her perception of seemingly natural realities of belonging and the nation state. She started to work on her first two novels open shutters, often a blender, and snowed under, unter Schnee, while studying German literature, psychology, and Northern American literature at the University of Potsdam and NYU. Both novels were immediately published after Antje completed her master's degree. She has also written two very well-received travel essay books on Sweden and her home state, Brandenburg, next to six other novels. And actually, I had put down three, but it was six. And he reminded me that it was six. And I should have known that. But right away, her novels have found critical acclaim, and she has been the recipient of several prestigious prizes, such as the Hermann Hesse Prize and the German Critics Prize, the Deutscher Kritikerpreis. Moreover, Antje has turned two of her novels into radio plays that aired in 2008 and 2011. She has translated Joan Didion's latest books, or the latest two books, and a collection of essays. And Joan Didion is a writer who has influenced her tremendously. Antje will give today's reading from her novels Colder Layers of Air, Kältere Schichten der Luft, published in 2007, and Into the Woods of the Human Heart. The latter presents a continuation of the former with regards to Antje's conceptualizations of gender, queer desire, and the crossing of boundaries. So please help me to welcome Antje Ravik-Strubel to Swarthmore College.
Yeah, thank you, Ute, and hello, everybody. I'm very excited to be here. When Ute came up with this idea of inviting me and Jack Halberstam together, I thought, wow, this is cool, let's do it. Now I'm a bit nervous. but I want to thank you both, Ute and Patty, for inviting me, having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk to you, Jack. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. As you've heard, I'm going to read some excerpts from these two novels, but I also want to give you a little introduction into them and into my writing. So, yeah, you have an idea about it, because both novels are not fully translated into English or have appeared in an American publishing house. In the last 10 years, I wrote actually three novels, which each in their own way deal with who we desire and how, or who do we become in the act of desiring, and who are we not supposed to desire. And since love and desire are still in some way connected to the romantic concept as it was invented in the late 18th century, I realized at some point that that romantic love is only, or is based on the attraction between two people who are not related by blood and are of the opposite sex. So everybody else is not supposed to feel romantic passion. It's not meant for a son and mother, for instance. It's not meant for women who love girls being boys, for boys with a female body who refuse to be somebody's circus horse, or celibate men who were born as females and love women. But all these characters appear in these recent novels, which I consider, for that reason, a trilogy, because they have the same kind of umbrella topic. Especially in Colder Layers of Air and this latest book, the episodic novel, Into the Woods of the Human Heart, I have the feeling I subvert this, what we call the binary gender concept and the heteronormative narratives which dominate nowadays literature, let alone life. What inspired me particularly to write Colder Layers of Air was the question, what would it be like not only to live as two genders simultaneously, but also to have two ages simultaneously? Like, let's say, being 15 and 30 at the same time. So my main character, Anya, is a dropout in her early 30s who spends the summer at a canoe camp in Sweden. And there she gets to know a woman who appears from a lake. Like, she's this kind of fairy that appears. She's not a fairy, she's a realistic person, but she kind of appears from a lake. And addresses Anya as the boy Schmoll. After a while, these two women engage in a love story in which they are teenagers of the opposite sex. But at the same time, they remain women, so they never fully transit into being these teenagers. And they also don't love each other as if they were teenagers, but from my understanding, it's their desire through which they become teenagers, one of them also becoming a boy. Anya and the woman from the lake are present. At the same time, these two teenagers are present and take shape on their bodies. And in fact, it seems crucial for the desire of the woman from the lake that the boy Schmoll is displayed against the backdrop of Anya's female body. This never-ending transformation is reflected by a narrative which constantly shifts between the first person and the third person. So you can see it as a this kind of these images that go back and forth between two or show two pictures, in, you know, no matter what, or depending on how you turn them. So in this book, I was interested, I think, mainly in subverting the notion of this either or the notion of being only the one or the other, like you have to decide to be one in particular. I aimed at undermining the gender dichotomy into being one as well as the other, and still write a realistic text about it, which is kind of difficult, I felt. And so that you get an idea of maybe how it starts or how it works, I'm going to read a very short excerpt of the beginning of this book, Kältere Schichten der Luft, and that you also get a feeling for the language in German. I'm going to read the first few sentences in German first. Vom Licht wussten sie alles. Sie kannten es in jeder Schattierung. Sie hatten gesehen, wie es den Himmel brüchig und zerrissen erscheinen ließ oder blau-schwarz gewachst. Sie wussten, wie das Licht unter anschäumenden Wolken aussah, wie es schräg einfiel am Fjell, wie es die Felsen hoch oben den Wald und am Seeufer das dichte Unterholz traf. Sie wussten, wie flüchtig, wie trügerisch es war. Erstrahlte der See eben noch türkis bis zum Grund, lag er im nächsten Moment schon stumpf und geschlossen da wie Asphalt. Yeah, this book starts with the description of light, or how the light falls onto the lake, on the one hand beautifully, on the other hand also signaling some threat, or the threat of an exposure, of being seen, of maybe being limited by the gaze. And now I'm going to read the English version. I'm very fortunate to have a very good translator. It was translated by Zaya Alexander. They had seen how the light made the pines and blackberry bushes appear mud in the rain. They had seen how the roads looked at 4 in the morning, devastated by falling rocks, and at noon on neatly mown Swedish front lawns. They knew it in the shimmering yellow from the heat, in the greenish glow of the evening. They could say how it looked above the roof of the tool shed on overcast days. They knew how faces change when glaring light falls upon them. Every morning, when they left their tents and went to the wash area, they had to cross the grassy field that had been cleared from the forest. There the faces became stable. They changed from milky gray, the color of night, into a harsh, polished tan. They knew it. They saw it every morning. And later, when only a few clouds were left in the sky, this tan had a certain sharpness, as faces only here have on this peninsula. It was brutal how the sun shone. Nobody spoke about the light. One morning, a girl was walking alone on the shore. The girl stepped between the boats, her dress blue. It was a light dress. Nobody wore dresses here. In the camp, they wore Gore-Tex sandals and gray or beige functional trousers with zippers at the thighs. When it got warm, they simply tore off the pant legs. The girl walked down to the dock. She moved drunkenly. She walked without stopping to remove her dress. She walked to the edge of the dock and plunged into the water. The people near the boats were startled by her body slapping the water. They looked over. The lake was calm. The girl surfaced next to a boy. Her hair stuck to her head. She swam back slowly. The others lost interest. They returned to their clipboards and wrote down the numbers of the boats that would go out that day. The girl climbed slowly back on land. She came ashore. The water running over her face didn't seem to bother her. She stopped close to the pines. Schmoll, she said, and she turned to me. You are a smart boy. You paid close attention the whole time. She gazed at the swimming area covered in raspberry bushes and buckthorn, and I saw she wasn't a girl anymore. I'm sure you can tell me where the towels are. I was inadvertently standing close to where she came ashore. I wasn't by the boats. I stood somewhat apart from the dock. Now I moved as if I'd been standing there frozen for hours. I'm not Schmoll, I said, and I'm not a boy. She tilted her head to the side and looked at me. Her brows were dark from the water and a very pale face. The lake was calm this morning. The seabirds drifted further on. The others had probably finished with the boats. She blocked my path as I moved to leave. I just want to see something, she said, and came closer. Her skin was white, a white that was reminiscent of shiny, smooth, polished wood you sometimes find on wild beaches. Her toes briefly grazed the sand. She wanted to touch my naked foot, missed it, and stumbled. She would have fallen if I hadn't held her. She put her arms around my neck. I smelled her wet hair. It was early morning, the sand was cool, the shadows fell long. We stood there like a billboard at the zoo metro station, one of these glossy photos, petite little girls nestled in the strong arms of confident boys, boys who looked down at their girls and the kudam. We fit perfectly into this image. Are you okay? I said. She pressed herself against me. To the others, it must have seemed as if I wanted to strip off her dress, slide the cloth slowly up her thighs. They must have imagined how she'd look naked, her hips, her butt, how I'd hold her in the sand, on the shore, hidden behind the bushes. Her body pulsated. Her skin glowed beneath the wetness. You see, she said in my ear, I finally found you. I knew it. Then she let go of me immediately. She grabbed her towel from near the pines and walked across the sand towards the street. She walked quickly. She didn't turn around. Her legs were lanky under the dress. It was a child's dress, a dress for very young girls. I wasn't sure. I kept looking at her, and since nobody by the boats noticed her, I yelled, Hey, why don't you get changed and have breakfast with us? She didn't react. She reached the road. I went back to the others. They hauled a few boats from the water and tilted them belly up on the beach. Slowly, it grew warmer. Later in the washroom, I looked at myself in the mirror. I wore jeans and a light blouse, unisex, typical outdoor clothing. I was strong and slim. I was tanned like all the others. My hair had this straw-colored, washed-out look from swimming in the lake. I had been living outdoors for 4 weeks. The scar above my eyebrow was the only thing that distinguished me from the others. I went out into the sun again, where they were busy planing wood. They were building a tipi from smooth, polished tree trunks, and it was going well. The bark peeled off in soft, long splinters. They knew how to apply pressure lightly to remove the upper layer without damaging the wood. They'd done it often. I joined them for a while. I began at the tips. I watched the men covertly and found nothing in them that resembled me. Yeah, I was talking about colder layers first because I think without having written this book, I couldn't have written the one I'm going to talk about now, because this Anya character is somewhat a Vorläufer, I don't know what Vorläufer means. I used her as let's say, the Lee character a bit on this Anya becoming Schmoll character. So she is maybe some kind of a mirror image or something of Lee, and Lee is one of the characters in the book I'm going to talk about now. Anya Schmoll, as you've heard, was basically written in an eye perspective before it changes into the third person narration sometimes. And Lee, on the other hand, that is one of the characters in the new book, is always seen through the eyes of others. So I never go into his perspective, but I always look at him through the eyes of other characters. And here the third person narrative leaves no doubt about Lee's masculinity. So he's always signified with the male personal pronoun, although he has a female body. And with him, I think I wanted to create a transgender character who the reader perceives in a certain way through the eyes of Emily, who is also a character I'm going to read. Like, she's part of the story I'm going to read now. And Emily perceives him as erotic and desirable. But maybe I tell you a bit more about the book in general, because I only have the small excerpt. Lee is one of 10 characters who circle around each other in an erotically charged and melancholic La Ronde. Like if you think of Schnitzler and Der Reigen, it's kind of the same principle that the characters appear and disappear and then appear again in different situations and are all linked in a certain way to each other. But sometimes this La Ronde is also violated by mostly male, but not only, brutality. So there are 13 interwoven episodes, and the overall topic for me is transformation, transition, passages, being on the way to something, never arriving there, or something like that. And every episode is like a chamber piece between two or three characters. And all of them are thrown into an overwhelming and sometimes threatening landscape. So they're all situated in, as we will hear, in the Sequoia Park in the US, in Swedish Lapland, in Germany, on some island, or in the icy forest of Finland. And all these characters, they don't live there, they just happen to be there or go there on holidays or passing through. And the conflict that I'm showing in each episode causes a severe change in the characters who are involved in it. Either their living situation changes, or their emotional landscape, or their language changes, or their sexuality, or their gender. And you could say their emotional movements are in a way reflected by the geographical movements as they move from one place to the other, from one landscape to another. I will give you maybe two examples of how it works, although it might be a bit confusing since you haven't read the book, but just, maybe you see how that works. There's, for instance, Helen, a girl from Germany who goes to LA to study there, and there she meets Faye and falls in love with Faye. Faye is a university teacher. Faye is still mourning about her childhood friend Emily. But finally, Faye falls in love with Helen and gives up her teaching job and moves to Germany. Meanwhile, Helen, though, fell in love with Sarah, who was formerly married to Norman. And so Faye, Helen, and Sarah end up living in a relationship of three. This is one storyline. Then going back to Emily and Lee, whom I'm going to introduce you to now. Emily meets Lee at the university in California. They separate, or rather Emily disappears after having met him, and she leaves the United States. She becomes a translator and falls in love with another character who before was together with Katya, and Katya is the second transgender character in this book, because Katya turns out to be Kat in the end of the book, and Kat is an androgynous man who has a love story with a woman, but is insecure about his sexuality, or about having sex, rather. So maybe I'm just going to read now the beginning of this episode with Emily and Lee. It's the second episode in the book, and it's called The White Rock. The White Rock, Sequoia National Park, California, USA. They had booked a room in the Ponderosa Lodge. It was a spacious room with two large beds and a balcony. Sequoias stood close to the window. The trees were too tall to see the tops, ancient giants with massive trunks and reddish brown bark that looked like deerskin. The trees were so famous that the area where they grew in great quantities, was named after them and declared a national park. The entrances to the park were marked with red posts and a boom gate that stayed open during the season. Signs warned about the dangers of the wilderness. Visitors were reminded that they wanted to leave the park alive and therefore requested to keep alert. Emily had made fun of it. Wasn't that actually the point? To get out unharmed? Out of a car, a bed, an illness, a dream? Wasn't that the point, as long as you live, to emerge from life unscathed? Lee had said such things were posted at the entrance to all national parks. They marked the boundary between what people thought was natural and actual nature, but they were basically just a barometer. The dramatic signs indicated the degree humans feared the wilderness, which varied by the season and had nothing to do with life's real dangers. Emily nodded, since Lee had more experience in these things than she. They had parked the rental car in front of the lodge and checked into their room. It was 2 in the afternoon. Tom wasn't there yet. Lee left the room and went over to the restaurant one more time. It was a rugged mountain restaurant, a dining room with massive wooden tables, coarsely planed benches, and a long bar that also served as the reception. Lots of whiskey and tequila bottles lined the shelves behind it, evidence that neither Mexico nor Texas was far away. Next to the bottle rack, somebody had stuck a piece of handwritten cardboard on the wall to cheer up the guests. If all else fails, there's always delusion. Emily grabbed the towels from the beds. They were of the same brown tone as the bedspreads tucked tightly over the mattresses. Despite the glaring sun, the room was dim. Emily brought the towels into the bathroom, and then Lee came back and said, "He's already here," and hastily gathered his things, the pad of paper with the list of questions, both books if he needed to look up quotes, the small recording device, and the scarf he had with him for all the other interviews. "It's too hot," said Emily. "It's almost 90 degrees out there." "I know, I'm not wearing it to protect me from the cold. Clothes ought to be less about conforming to meteorology. The functions of things like clothing, and not only clothing, should be suspended more often. I think people should use them differently."
30 degrees and a scarf," Emily said. "Tom will think you're either sick or crazy. That's what I think."
Lee looked at her. "I'll get us a table in the shade."
Emily liked being on the road with Lee. She liked hitting the bars in Culver City with him on Friday nights until it got light, and then eat nachos for breakfast with him on the steps outside his house, and now she'd loved nothing more than to be here alone with him. At the beginning of the semester, he had sat in a poorly attended seminar. He wore baggy jeans, a jacket that protruded over the shoulders, a pair of round sunglasses on his short hair. Emily had felt the need to be near him. She didn't know him. She had never seen that student before. As she headed towards his table, he looked up, calmly, without smiling, gazed at her. A stop the mind makes between uncertainties. He made no attempt to talk to her, just pushed the scattered books with his arms over to his side of the table, but from the moment Emily sat next to him, she wasn't restless anymore. Now here's a big piece of the story missing, so let me quickly summarize it for you. What's missing is that Lee is interviewing this Tom. He is a writer, and he's interviewing him for his master's thesis. And Tom starts a conversation or talks about how the moral in society changed during the last years. And he says that first sexuality was the means for transgression, and now genuine feelings and emotions are the new frontier, since gang rape and porno and all this crap have replaced any real encounter where you have to put yourself on the line. And then he says something like, nobody can tell kitsch from violence anymore. And while Lee is interviewing this writer, Emily meets a biker gang, and a guy comes on to her. He asks her in an abusive way to take a ride with him. So I have two different masculinities here. One is the masculinity of the motorcyclists, like the group. And on the other hand, it's this writer, Tom, who is a cynic, but then actually also shows a very soft and fragile side. And this is kind of the background for Lee's own masculinity. And after this interview, they drive out to the White Rock, because Tom recommended to go there. It's supposedly very beautiful, and they have to see it, so they do it. The White Rock was 2 miles away from the Ponderosa Lodge. For the Chumash, it had been a holy site. They had worshipped it before they were driven out, and the area placed under the protection of the authorities. Emily and Lee took the car. They parked it in front of a boom gate in the woods. Only rangers were allowed to drive any further. Although it was late in the afternoon, the light fell starkly between the trunks and made them look narrower. They walked one behind the other, Emily behind Lee, and before they reached the rock, she said, "Luckily, you got Tom to talk before I joined you." "He was talking," Lee said, "but he didn't say anything." They followed a stream until the path branched off. It was exactly as Tom had described it to Lee. After a short hike, they reached the edge of the forest. Before them lay a large, flat, somehow polished stone. Solitarily, it stood out from the woodlands. It was completely white. The surface was slanted. It looked like a lodge in an amphitheater hewn by nature before the stage of the white sprawling valley. I was furious, Emily said. He didn't take you seriously. They sat down on the stone. It was warm and smooth, and it was nice to sit there and feel the texture of the rock on the soles of the feet and bare legs. He just did his same old routine, Emily said. At the end, he said a couple of unexpected things. Before them lay the valley, dense with leaves. The crowns of the sequoias stood out from the swaying green treetops. When the moon rises, it's supposed to be insanely beautiful, said Lee, and Emily nodded, and then Lee got undressed. He folded the scarf, pulled the t-shirt over his head, unbuttoned his jeans and took them off. He lost his balance and laughed. He dropped his jeans carelessly, stripped off his shorts, and shed the tight, sporty tank top. The sun was glowing orange on the horizon. Emily looked straight into the blinding center. When she turned back around, Lee was lying next to her on his back on the rock. He had closed his eyes, and it was up to Emily whether or not to look at this body. It was a tanned, muscular body, naked on a white stone. Emily was still wearing her knee-length summer dress. It's insanely beautiful right now, she said softly. It was warm, and the scent of night-blooming jasmine hung in the windless air. You never told me when you knew. What? Murmured Lee. When you knew you are a boy. Lee didn't move. His arms were stretched out, the palms facing downwards as though tracing the firmness of the stone. Only a small muscle that ran from the elbow to the wrist tensed briefly. And, as if following an almost unconscious impulse, Emily leaned forward and kissed the spot where the muscle had just appeared. Not so long, said Lee. Emily's lips burned. It made her think of the glowing threads Tom had talked about and of the snow. And you, said Lee, how long have you wanted to ask me that? From the very first day when you took off your sunglasses. I thought so. That's how you always looked at me. Emily said nothing. I've known it since I first felt it, said Lee, first hand. Ever since then, I've felt like I've outgrown everything. Like a sequoia? Yes, Lee smiled with his eyes closed, like a sequoia. Emily poured cola into the two metal cups they had brought and filled each of the cups with a generous splash of bourbon, even though the bartender had warned that Maker's Mark was too mild to mix with other drinks. Emily took a sip and didn't think the bourbon was too mild or the cola too sweet. The ratio of the mix was exactly right. And now you view everything from above? I wish. Lee stretched out an arm and Emily handed him the metal cup. He looked at Emily over the rim of the cup. I don't view anything, he said. I've outgrown everything, like clothes that are too tight. Can't you find new ones? No. You don't have anything that's not too tight? Emily asked. No, said Lee. Then there's no exception whatsoever? No, said Lee again and hit the rock with the flat of his hand. Emily stared into her cup. And what was it like when you noticed it? I was 21. Emily swirled the whiskey cola around a few times before taking a big gulp. She was 2 years older than me, said Lee, paused. I needed to look at her all the time. I wanted to hear her voice. I wanted to inhale her. I wanted to watch her sleep. Lee lay on his back with his eyes closed, and Emily looked at him. I wanted to sleep with her, on the floor, on the blanket in the woods, on the beach, in the car. I wanted to be slow. I wanted to consume us. I wanted her to burn me up. Thighs, loins, my abdomen, my palms. It was so intense it hurt, as if the body was being painfully expanded. Tom put it nicely earlier. Lee's chest and curved chin and forehead shimmered in the light that now was red, a reflection of the sun that disappeared behind the trees. Couldn't think about anything else, Lee said. I kept imagining it all the time. On her, above her, in her. Then we did it. She showed me. And it was right. Even though I didn't have a cock yet. Emily focused on the arms. She studied Lee's upper arms and elbows, and then her gaze slid down the body to the feet, which were turned slightly outwards, the heels resting on the rock. They were sturdy feet with long, slender toes. But you were already a boy, she said. Yes, the rest came later, weeks, months later, when I bought my first pair of blue boxer shorts and I found a gorgeous specimen at a dildo factory that suited me perfectly. That wasn't the main thing. It was just an addition. Show me, whispered Emily. The main thing was the longing, said Lee. This totally unprecedented longing had obsessed me completely. Show me, said Emily again. Lee laid there and said nothing, and the sky grew darker, and with the darkness came a chill. Lee's nipples hardened, his shoulders had goosebumps. Just a little, said Emily quietly and without looking at Lee. Just while we are here on this rock. It doesn't work. Why not? Emily asked after a while, but Lee did not answer. She reached into the bag behind her and pulled out a towel. She carefully spread the towel over his legs and belly. You don't have it with you, she said. Lee grabbed a stone. Somebody has to ignite it. And I can't? Lee tossed the stone into the sky and they followed it with their eyes. You don't need to fall in love right away, said Emily. Lee pulled the towel a little higher to his chest. Now his ankle peeked out from under the brown towel, which outlined the shape of his legs, the curvature of his knees, thighs, the hollow of the lap where the cloth gave way. The towel was not long enough to cover the breasts, and Emily thought about what Lee had said earlier about the glowing thread, and she thought about the stone he had tossed in the air and that it hadn't landed. What's keeping the moon? They looked across the darkening valley. The green of the trees had transformed into a black wall, before which a single shadowy sequoia stood out. It stood out against the dark line of the horizon, which resembled a low fence by comparison. They stayed there for a while, their arms propped behind them, and watched whether the moon rose. Do you think Tom saw something? Lee said. Tom? He was suddenly so different. What's a guy like him going to see? He looked at me totally differently, as if I'd thrown him. But that wasn't you, said Emily. Lee sat up, he pushed the towel aside, and Emily saw the beautiful dark body against the brightness of the stone one more time, before Lee stood up to gather his things that were scattered over the rock. Lee got dressed. First he put on his shorts and the jeans, then the tank top and t-shirt, and everything went in reverse motion. Because of the scarf, he said. Maybe it made me look crazy after all. Usually they turned it into a big deal when they realized something's not quite right, that suddenly they can't recognize themselves in the person sitting across from them anymore. Who recognizes themselves in anything, said Emily fiercely. She poured whiskey into the cups, the metallic gray blurred with white shadow of the rock, and she had to be careful not to miss the cup. No matter how you look, and Tom isn't exactly the smartest cookie in the jar about those things. Maybe, Lee said quietly. But what if you don't want to keep your illusions as the only reality anymore? Sure, you can pack your bags and take off. The question is where you'll end up. When in doubt, nowhere, he said. In the internalized outside of this great society in which we live, Tom definitely saw something. You sure are smug about it, Emily said. So what do you think I look like? Behind them, the rock sloped slightly upwards until it reached the edge of the woods, and before them was the valley, and if you wandered northward to the furthest end, it would lead into the desert. Emily shivered. Her summer dress was thin, and as night was falling, it grew cold. Anyway, there's no moon today, she said. Just wait. If we'd thought of it earlier, we could have gathered some wood, so we could at least make a fire. Lee took off his scarf and put it around Emily's shoulders. Better? A little. You are right about the looks. They don't matter as long as you don't get into trouble for using public ladies' rooms. Urinals segregation, said Emily. Cut the crap with your French theorists. When you read them, all you end up with is carbonated blood. But guess what I read? Scandinavians put hermaphrodite icons on their bathroom doors. Stick figures with one leg in pants, the other in a skirt. The question remains, said Lee, why we have this endless need to mark a basic necessity, which is shared by all species in the animal world, with a cultural gender code, when our pissing habits aren't much different than bears. Emily drank the rest of the whiskey cola. If the moon doesn't rise, she said, we won't find our way back. Lee laughed. No, seriously. It had suddenly grown dark. The blackness around them wasn't broken by anything, except for a very faint glow from the stone. Are you scared? We don't have a flashlight. Emily thought of the warning signs in front of the park entrances. A while back in the Topanga Mountains, a family was mauled by a mountain lion. The Topanga Mountains were not the Sequoia Park, but there were mountain lions everywhere. And in Sequoia Park, there were also rattlesnakes and brown bears that sometimes were visible from the hiking trails. Tom knew we'd be in trouble without the moon. Bullshit, said Lee. If you want, I'll go and look. Lee stood up to look for the path they had taken. As long as he stayed on the white rock, his silhouette was visible, but after a few steps into the darkness, it became one with it. The problem was finding the point where the dirt trail led to the rock. The path didn't have a sign. The transition from being out in the open to the enclosed trees at the edge of the forest was not marked. In the afternoon, parts of the path were hidden by foliage from last autumn. Emily wrapped the scarf tightly around her. Her toe started hurting again. She was cold. She started to imagine what it would feel like to sleep next to Lee, lie with him on the bare rocks on his body, wrapped in the towels and in his scarf, protected from mountain lions and brown bears. In a night like this, she would get to know everything. The restlessness of spring would be resolved. She couldn't imagine what she would get to learn, know anything. But that was part of it, because it's always learned, flashed through her mind, as long as you don't know something, about another person's body. It is impossible to imagine anything. Lee knew that. He had more experience than she. Emily listened into the night. It was still. There was no noise. The air didn't move. The darkness was a big balloon that expanded, and she became smaller in its center. The points of contact with the rock she was sitting upon also became smaller, and in order to hold on to something, she turned around.
Thank you.